The 100 Years' War, the Dagestan period, the Battle of Rusbeck. This is going to be the end of the Flanders Rebellion. Philip van Artevelde was at Ghent when the news came that the French had crossed the Lys. He left at once to rejoin the army at Oudenarde. An English herald, the former Chandos herald, biographer of the Black Prince, succeeded in making his way there from Calais, under cover of his immunity, bearing news of the current status of the discussions with King Richard II's council. For the first time, van Artevelde realized there was no chance of help arriving from England in time. If he had been wise, he would have now fought a defensive campaign in the boggy terrain around Oudenarde, grinding down his enemy over the winter months. But the Battle of Bevershutsveld had swelled van Artevelde's confidence and sapped what wisdom he had, if he ever had any. He put his host in marching order and advanced west to seek out the French army in the plain north of Ypres. On November the 20th and the 21st of 1382, the Flemings left Cantrai. On the 25th, they passed through Roeselare. Towards dusk, they halted at a high ridge overlooking the road from Ypres, just south of the village of West Rosbeck, but the French called it Rusbeck. The place lay about 6 miles north of the French encampment. Here they began to dig themselves in. On the following day, November the 26th, the French, many of whom had been hurriedly recalled from plundering raids across western Flanders, formed up in battle order and advanced north towards the enemy. A steady drizzle fell as they came to a halt in the sodden plain in front of the Flemish positions. A group of Louis de Mal's Flemish-speaking knights passed through the whole length of the Flemish camp in disguise to reconnoiter the enemy positions. They reported that there were about 40,000 men in the Flemish host. Apart from about 60 English archers, they were untrained townsmen in disorderly formations with rough weapons. They were occupying, however, a strong position on rising ground, their flanks protected by woodland and thick hedges, and their front by a line of trenches. There was no natural protection for the Flemish army from behind. In spite of their superiority of position and their vastly greater numbers, Clisson resolved upon a frontal attack on the following morning. In the early hours of November the 25th, the French moved slowly forward in three divisions. The vanguard was commanded by the constable and the marshals. The largest division was in the center. It included the king, riding with his three uncles, and the Lord of Cousay. They were surrounded by a personal bodyguard of 400 men, including the Welsh company of Jack Wynne. The rear guard was taken up by companies from the western provinces, Artois, Picardy, and Normandy. A contemporary described the eerie sound of the metal on metal as the links of 10,000 tunics of chainmail shifted against each other and the steel helmets clinked against their shoulder armor. At the foot of the ridge on which the Flemings were standing, the French halted, dismounted, sent their horses to the rear. About 1,000 feet now separated the two armies, but each was concealed by a thick mist. Arrows and other missiles were hurled aimlessly into the opposing lines. Then, as the king's standard-bearer unfurled the oriflamme, the mist suddenly lifted and the bright winter sun lit up the two armies. The first French division pounded up the slope of the ridge to assail the Flemings. Van Artevelde had drawn his men up in a single mass with his strength concentrated in the center around the banner of St. George. Their ordered formation and strict line discipline was far more impressive than the French had been led to expect. Several batteries of artillery covered the ground by which the French were approaching. A hail of arrows and metal shot struck the first groups as it reached the crest. Several prominent knights fell dead. The center of Clisson's line was forced back and began the retreat down the slope, but the French men-at-arms were still advancing on the wings. Then the second French division, commanded by the Duc de Bourbon and the Lord of Cousay, outflanked the Flemings and fell on their unprotected rear. Many years later, the Duke of Bourbon's standard-bearer recalled seeing the two divisional commanders swing their axes left and right through the dense ranks of the enemy. The king and the Duke of Burgundy had withdrawn from their division to a nearby hillock. They watched as the wings of the French first line enveloped the Flemings, and the men of Cousy and Bourbon crushed them from behind. The French now began a methodical massacre of their enemy. The Flemings panicked. Their line broke. They disintegrated into a terrified, formless mass, fleeing wherever they could find an opening. Enguerrand de Cousy organized companies of men-at-arms and pursuit squads to chase down the those who had managed to get away from the melee. They hacked them to the ground as they fled across the fields. A group of several hundred Flemings tried to rally in a copse of wood, only to be surrounded and cut down like their fellows. The slaughter continued until nightfall. The battle had lasted less than 2 hours. As always in medieval battles, most of the casualties were suffered in the final stages, and almost all on the defeated side. The macabre count of the bodies organized by the heralds after it was over, found only about 100 French casualties, but no fewer than 27,500 Flemish dead, according to Florentine Bonorcorso Pitti, who was present at the battle. 9/10 of the Flemings' corpses bore no wounds. They had been crushed to death in the press of the defeated army, drowned as they tried to cross a large pond in their rear, or smothered face down in the mud as their companions trampled over them in a bid to get away. About 3,000 Flemings were found wounded but alive on the battlefield. They were finished off with knives and axes as they lay on the ground. A handful of prominent Flemish survivors were taken prisoners and later beheaded on the orders of the Count of Flanders. The body of Philip van Artevelde was found in a ditch, smothered beneath the corpses of his bodyguard. The body was identified by a wounded Flemish prisoner and brought to the 14-year-old king. He had it hanged by the neck from a nearby tree. It was later delivered up to Louis de Mal, who sent it to Ypres to be broken on the wheel in the marketplace, together with the bodies of two of his lieutenants. Some, even among Louis' supporters, believed that greater honor was due to men, however lowly born, who had died in battle. The Battle of Ruysbeek was followed by the collapse of the rebellion throughout Flanders, and that's what we'll be looking at next time, the final collapse of the Flanders Rebellion. Now, the sources for this: The Hundred Years' War, The Chronicles by Froissart, The Hundred Years' War by Perrois, The Hundred Years' War by Nylans, and The Hundred Years' War, The House Divided, Volume 3 by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.